Session, we're going to talk about indirect detection. White chalk. Yeah. So, in direct detection experiments, what we're looking for is, as we discussed before, dark matter that's scattering off of nuclear targets that we have here, just on Earth. With indirect detection, the idea is to look for dark matter annihilating in the galaxy and to look for the products of that annihilation signal. The self-annihilation won't be a large effect, but it should happen, in some cases, it should happen often enough that it could give something detectable. And so for these kinds of searches, what we want to do is use satellites or telescopes that look for high energy gamma rays in certain areas of the sky where we expect that there should be a fairly high density of dark matter, right? Because if we're looking for a self-annihilation, we want to, you know, that'll happen more commonly in regions that just have a lot of dark matter in it. So some of the most common places to look are dwarf galaxies, which are dark matter dominated galaxies, and then also the center of the galaxy. So we're going to get to all of that, and I'll show you some of the experimental results that we now have. But to just kind of set up the problem, the important quantity here for indirect detection is the intensity profile for the annihilation. So all the physics is really going to be in here. So this intensity profile is going to be a function of the energy of the annihilation product, an angular coordinate, and I'll give you a little map so you can see what all the angular coordinates mean in a second. It depends on the velocity average annihilation cross-section. And then we just have some other factors. Okay, so this is the annihilation cross-section. It also depends on the photon energy spectrum. I'm going to write down all of these components now, and then we're going to kind of break this down bit by bit. Photon energy spectrum. And then lastly, there's an integral over the line of sight of the dark matter, well, the density, which depends on distance from the center of the galaxy. Now, there's an exponent here. What should it be? 2, yes. So this exponent should be 2 because we're talking about dark matter annihilating. So we need to be able to pull out 2 dark matter particles from this density profile and for this annihilation to occur. How would that exponent change if we were just looking for decay of dark matter? 1, yeah. So if it was just dark matter decay, then it would just be a factor of rho in here. And pretty much everything I'm going to say will translate over very smoothly to the case of dark matter decay, except for the fact that this exponent is different, yeah?
Is there any physical case for preferring some kinds of, like, either 1 decay or 2 annihilation or something like that, or is it just a lamppost kind of thing that we're looking for?
It depends on the models, but you can get either signature. So in the WIMP scenario, you tend to get this kind of annihilation signal, which is why I'm going to kind of focus on that. But yeah, you can very easily get the dark matter decay, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. All right, so to give you, just to define these angular variables a little bit better. Okay, so here's the center of the galaxy. Here we are. And I'm going to put here, this is going to be our gamma ray source. So let's say if I have the annihilation occurring here at this point in the sky. And so this distance here from the annihilation point to the galactic center is just the radius, right? So that's the r that's going in here. This distance from the annihilation source to us is L. And then this angle here is psi, okay? So what's relevant for the integral, right, is the density of the dark matter at the point where it's annihilating, so at R here. And then what we observe is the integration over this entire line of sight. So this is important. When we see a signal in the sky, you know, we have our little telescope here and it's looking out. We can't tell if it's here, 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 or here. The only thing we see is sort of the integrated flux from this particular direction on the sky. So that's why the integration here is over the line of sight. It's sort of summing up everything in this direction. Okay. All right, so now there's several ways that we can get photons from dark matter annihilation. The first case that I'm going to consider is the one where we have dark matter coming in. Let's stay agnostic as to how exactly it annihilates. And then it produces things like W bosons, Z bosons, quarks, leptons, etc. And then these states, what ends up happening is they'll decay. Well, so if it's W and Z, let me consider those cases first. So if it's W and Z, they'll decay primarily to quarks. Those quarks will then end up forming mesons. So you'll get a bunch of pions from that. And then those pions will decay to give you photons. So you do end up getting photons. It's just after kind of a multi-step process. Where this, that you get showering in here, and then you end up with pions, and then those pions are the things that are going to decay to give you the photons. So what we can look for are, at the end of the day, are these photons, but in this particular case, the photons are the secondary annihilation products, right? They're not coming directly from the annihilation, they're only coming from the decay. So this is where that factor up there, the photon energy spectrum, comes into play. Because the spectrum of energy for the photons that come out of the shower are going to depend on what the initial annihilation products are. So for example, so I'm going to do this in terms of the variable x, which is just energy over the mass of the dark matter. But this is essentially just the photon energy spectrum, which I gave you up there. So if I have dark matter annihilation to WW, this looks something like that. Make that one white. If I instead have annihilation to taus here rather than to w's, it'll tend to look more like this. Okay. Yeah, so when you produce leptons and then you look for photons from those showers, you tend to get, you tend to get more photons at higher energies than you do when it's when you're producing W bosons. So as the first exercise for the afternoon, I want you to sort of sketch what you think the following lines are going to look like. So chi chi to ZZ, running out of colors, and then also chi chi to BB bar And let's throw in chi chi to electron electron. And it doesn't have to be specific, just draw the lines relative to what I've given you for the tau and the W.
So something is very but they can. I guess when it's close to the times we can, I guess that's the one that really means the
Sorry? Is what? DND. Oh. Yeah, this is where I'm going to start using X's and chi's, and they're going to probably start looking the same. Okay. Yeah, that's DNDX. Yeah. Tell me if something's confusing and I'll. All right. This seems to have caused a lot of debate. Are there thoughts? Let's start with chi chi to ZZ. okay, let's simplify the question, which is, should it look more like WW or tau tau? All right, why? Okay, similar mass. There's another reason too.
They both produce jets?
Yeah, they'll both decay predominantly to quarks. And so the showering process will actually be similar for the Z's, for the, you know, the quarks you get from the Z's and from the W. So in both of these cases, you're going to go predominantly to quarks. Those quarks will form mesons. You'll get pions. Those pions will decay to give you photons. And if nobody kind of wants to go on the record in terms of putting a line, I will put one on there for you. It's pretty much the same thing as WW. But your intuition was totally right. What? Yes.
WW have a little sharpening at the end.
A little sharpening? What do you mean?
A little. It doesn't go to zero quite so fast at one. Way down.
Oh yeah. Yes. I'm being very heuristic in the sketching, but yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, BB bar. More like Tao Tao. Why?
Actually, no.
Yeah, yeah. So pretty much, if it goes to quarks, if it goes to quarks, it all kind of ends up looking pretty similar.
But Tau Tau also decays hadronically. But Tau Tau can also decay hadronically. Like Tau's can decay hadronically.
Yeah, but it's not the dominant mode like these ones.
Why? It decays for an off shell W, right? 90% of the time.
Yes, no. I mean, it does, but you also, I don't know how to say this. I mean, like, the structure of the shower is going to be different because, like, it does go to W, and you end up getting these, like, three-prong decays. You don't end up getting, this is the way to say it, you don't end up getting as many pions from the tau decay as you do from these three.
Okay.
All right, and then the electron one, which I sort of went out on a whim in terms of putting it up there because I don't actually have the sketch out. But we'll just, is it more like this one or this one? It'll be more like the tau, but it will be different from tau for the reason that you said, because it's purely leptonic. And so it will, if I remember correctly, sort of be even more suppressed and more sharply push towards higher energy. Okay.
Sorry, can you explain that feature? Why it's so flat and then falls off so sharply?
Don't read too carefully into any features that I have drawn.
I just mean between the leptons compared to the hadronic decay. Like the hadronic decay seems to kind of smoothly fall off, whereas you.
Oh, this is just meant to say that you end up getting more high energy photons from radiated off of the leptons versus with the hadronic showering. Okay. Yeah. I've got the actual figure with all of this somewhere. If you want, we can go through it in more detail later. I just kind of want you to get the general gist of it from the sketch. All right. So in terms of, if you were going to sit down and make some predictions for your theory, what you would actually use for this photon energy spectrum, you would probably get from code. The most common code that's used for this is Pythia. And Pythia would model for you this showering process. And it would give you this curve at the end of the day, which then you would substitute into your expression above to calculate the intensity. Yeah?
Why don't the masses come into play? Like, why don't the masses change the spectrum at all?
Well, I'm plotting it in terms of energy divided by.
But in terms of W and Z masses, I would have thought that would produce, I guess, harder photons in the end of the day. Or I guess because they come from the same final state, they have the same energy, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of gets washed out from the shower. Yeah. Okay, so in this case where you end up having this continuum distribution, so this is often referred to as like a continuum distribution of photons that are coming from the annihilation, your intensity spectrum would look something like this. So your satellite or your telescope would be measuring the energy of the gamma rays. And it would counting up events, so the number of gamma rays it sees of particular energy. These types of backgrounds tend to fall like that, so I'll just sketch it on there. And then your dark matter signal would probably do something like this. Okay, so it's a continuum, kind of like a hump that's on there, and it's spread over a range of energies, And that's coming from, it's kind of getting shaped by this curve here. So to contrast that, let's consider what happens in the case where we have dark matter, annihilate directly to photons. So now the photons aren't, I mean, they're primary decay products. They're not coming from the showering. This case is somewhat special. It gives you actually a very interesting signal there. It's going to end up giving you a line in energies. But to see this explicitly, let's just work out the kinematics for this. So we have dark matter particle. Dark matter particle. Remember, this annihilation, this event is essentially non-relativistic because these guys aren't moving around that fast. So momentum of this guy is just mass. Same thing with this one. And then we get two, well, I want to generalize this actually. So I'm going to consider the case where it's a photon and then something else, where that something else is going to be a capital X. And that capital X may end up being another photon. It could be a Z boson, something like that. But I just want to consider the general case. So the for this one coming out, for the photon, its four momentum is going to be just this. Right, and for the other one, so if we just demand energy conservation, then we get the following: twice the mass of the dark matter from the initial, and then K plus the energy of this other particle, which I'm gonna write out as K squared plus its mass. You can solve this for K, and what you'd find is that it is approximately the mass of the dark matter times 1 minus m chi squared over 4 k squared. Oh, sorry. M chi 1 minus m chi 4. Oh. So given this, this essentially tells us the energy of the photon and, the energy of the photon that comes out, right, from this annihilation. And so in the limit where this is just another photon, then the mass here is zero, and the energy of the photon is just the mass of the dark matter. And that will change a little bit if this other particle is something massive. So if it's, let's say, a Z boson that comes out, right, that's going to shift the energy of this photon that I'm going to observe. But in both cases, the energy is going to be monochromatic, right? It's not a spread. It's essentially going to be peaked at a single value. So maybe just take a minute to make the corresponding plot that I drew there, except for this scenario, where the dark matter annihilates to, let's do the case where it annihilates to gamma gamma, and then also where it annihilates to gamma z. So what would the spectrum of energies be that you would observe in both of those cases.
Oh, I see. So that's
So why is
Or maybe So it peaks in the low end because
that's good. Which one, that one?
So does anybody want to suggest what I would see here if it was annihilation to gamma gamma? Yeah, it would be, it would look some, well, that's probably too big. You'd see a line at m, the mass of the dark matter. If it annihilated to gamma z, what would that look like? Shifted to the left?
Yeah.
And so continuous warp,
right? Yeah, well, the width would be, well, yes, that's a good point. What I'm showing here, what I'm sketching is just if you were only catching photons that were coming directly from the like the direct decay. But you're right that the Z boson coming out the other side will also itself produce some photons. That will end up changing the shape of the line, but you will tend to be dominated by this. Okay. So if you do have the case where you get direct, you're directly producing the photons, you get something of a, I mean, it's a quite spectacular signal, right? It's a line right at the dark matter mass or fairly close to it. It's the shape of it is considerably different than the shape of the background, so it would be easier to find. For a long time, people sort of refer to this as the smoking gun for dark matter detection because, you know, you see a line, you know it was there. I'm hesitant to use that because a few years ago there was hints of a line in data from one of the telescopes, and it turned out to be a systematic effect from the experiment. So, yeah, it got people initially very excited because, hey, it's a line that's supposed to be the smoking gun for dark matter, and then the situation turned out to be more complicated. Yeah?
Is this the 3.55?
No, it's the 130. There's a lot of these. This one's the 130 GeV line, but yeah. The 3.5 keV line is still survives. Yeah. The other thing that's really cool about this is sort of, and this is maybe a little bit pie in the sky, but would be awesome, good to dream, is in many cases, your dark matter model can give you a combination of these things. So, I mean, it just depends on what the branching fraction to the different modes are, but you might end up getting some continuum contribution and then also some decays to gamma gamma and gamma z. If that were the case, you can imagine doing something like dark matter spectroscopy, right? You would take your image, you would end up getting something that shows, you know, a bump and then two peaks. Based on the location of the peaks, it would tell you something about the mass of the candidate. And then also from this, you would actually be able to read off essentially what fraction of the time it's going to the different modes, and that would tell you a lot about just the properties of the dark matter and the sector that it's coming from, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I mean, that would be like, you know, being able to do dark matter spectroscopy with these images that you're getting from the sky. Obviously, you need to be lucky enough to have, you know, a bunch of things go right for you in order to be able to do that, but it certainly is fun to think about. There's one more bit that I want to discuss related to the intensity expression there. And that's the term that's coming in the integral, which is the astrophysics part of this. Oh, wait, no, my chalk. Okay. So that integral, the term in the integral, is sometimes referred to as a J factor. And it's sensitive to the assumptions that we make about the dark matter distribution. And in particular, so for example, if you're looking for this, these annihilations in the center of the galaxy, you're going to become very sensitive to what the dark matter distribution is near the center of the galaxy. And that's kind of where we have a lot of questions as to whether or not the simulations are giving us things we expect, et cetera, et cetera. So for example, I think I sketched this out for you yesterday, but you know, we have our NFW profile, which gives us some expectation of what the density should be near the center of the galaxy. But there can be other scenarios where the density is chord, something like this. So in this case, you'd actually expect to have less dark matter in the center of the galaxy than you might otherwise for the NFW profile. And in this kind of scenario, that would reduce the amount of photons you get from annihilation from this region of the sky. Yeah?
That's like how significant is that effect? Is it like a 10%
reduction? No, it could be quite significant. I mean, it's hard to give a fraction because it kind of depends on the assumptions that you're making, but we actually don't have very good observational constraints on just on how chord our Milky Way profile could be. So those studies would come from, as you might expect, measurements of stellar kinematics. And from that, we believe that the core, we can't exclude a core that's bigger than like 5 to 8 kiloparsecs. So we can have a density profile that's fairly flat up until where almost where we are, and that's not excludable. Is it likely? Probably not. I don't think any simulation has found a core that's that flat, but it's kind of, I don't know, it's sort of surprising to me that we haven't reached a point where we can actually exclude it observationally. And in the cases where you could have cores that are that flat, so in these strange scenarios, like it could really suppress a signal. Okay, so now you kind of have all of the bits so that we can start talking about what the observational constraints are. There are two main places in the sky, like I said, where we would look for this. The first is from dwarfs, from dwarf galaxies. So, yes.
What is NFW?
Oh, this one's NFW.
So what is?
Oh, Navarro-Frank-White. So it's the sort of universal profile that a lot of simulations seem to find for the density. Yeah. Okay, so most of the limits that I'm going to be showing you, the results that I'm going to show you today, are coming from the Fermi satellite. Which is shown here. It's at the moment providing some of the strongest bounds and the greatest sensitivity to this high energy gamma ray region. It was launched in 2008, and you can see from the energies that it's sensitive to, it's just over a wide range of energies and kind of in the sweet spot for dark matter annihilation. And the other positive with Fermi is that you get a map of the of these high energy gamma rays over the whole sky. So you can pretty much look wherever you want and see if you find these excesses of gamma rays. So one very well motivated place to start looking is in locations of the sky where we know that there are these dwarf galaxies. Dwarf galaxies are ideal for these kinds of studies because they're dark matter dominated. They don't have a lot of baryonic physics going on. So they tend to be very clean systems. So essentially, you know, Fermi's just kind of stares at this dark patch and just sees how many excess gamma rays it can find. The results from Fermi, right, are going to depend on this J factor for the dwarfs. So they depend very sensitively on how well we can actually measure this for dwarf galaxies. And that's kind of a question, an open question of how well we're doing on that. Measuring this J factor for dwarf galaxies is hard because there just aren't very many stars in these systems. So, you know, you might have five stars, and then based on the motions of those five stars, you're just trying to estimate the amount of enclosed mass. So there's a lot of assumptions that go into the determination of the J factors for these studies. That being said, this plot here shows the, I don't know, it's a little blurry. The y-axis is log base 10 of the J factor. And then the x-axis lists a bunch of known dwarf galaxies. So the points are what we believe the J factors of each of these dwarfs to be, and the error bars kind of indicate the amount of uncertainty that there is. You can see that there's variation, right? It depends on the, well, it depends on a variety of factors, but the location of the dwarf relative to us, and then also just the distribution inside the dwarf. Some of them are fairly high. So for example, like Ursa Major 2 here gives a fairly large J factor. Segway, this one's an interesting story. So Segway 1 was thought for a while to be a great because look, it gives a really high J factor. So that should give a large annihilation. And then recently it was found, they were kind of redoing the analysis. They realized that they included one wrong star that they thought was part of Segway. That's actually not part of Segway. That messed up their calculation of the J factor, and now it's tanked with huge error bars. We just don't really understand what's going on. So it's just something to keep in mind that the study of these J factors is something that's ongoing. It's definitely going to be getting better with time, but it is sort of a big uncertainty in our understanding of the like the ramifications of the studies for dwarf galaxies. Yeah?
Are those at the very bottom there?
Oh, I don't actually know what that is. I can't even read it on my screen. Yeah, I'm not sure what that angle is. Yeah. Yep.
How far away are these galaxies?
It varies a lot. I think Sagittarius is that one on here? Oh, Sagittarius isn't even on here. It varies a lot. I don't really have the numbers off the. I have a plot showing the location on the sky. I don't really know the distances off the top of my head for these ones, but I thought Sagittarius, which isn't actually shown on here, is one of the closer ones. I can give you a number that's a guess, but I 20 to 30 kiloparsecs ish, but don't write that down. Yeah, it's a bit kind of ish.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Good. All right, so these are the current bounds from Fermi looking for annihilation in dwarfs. So focus on the left-hand plot. So the way these limits are typically shown is with dark matter mass on the horizontal axis and then the annihilation cross-section on the vertical axis. They haven't seen any excess photons, which is why they're placing limits. The limit will depend on what the annihilation mode is, right? And we had this whole discussion here about how if you're assuming that it's leptonic decay versus W decay versus, you know, it can change. And so what I'm showing you there is their limit for decay, I keep saying decay, annihilation into BB bar, okay? You could probably guess, given the exercise we did before, that the limits for WW and ZZ aren't very different. But if you were to look at their limits for the leptonic decay modes, they would look different. Okay. Yeah.
Are those galaxies isolated or in groups or?
They're fairly isolated. Yeah, I'll show you a map showing where they are in the sky, but they're fairly spread out.
Would the environment have an effect would the environment affect in some way those response?
It could potentially, so in the sense that, right, when if it happened to be somewhere, remember what we're doing here is integrating over the whole line of sight. It could be, let's say my dwarf is here, but there happens to be some gas cloud or something right along the same line of sight, but in front of it. That's going to contaminate my field of view and could end up affecting measurements of the J factor and things like that. So yeah, there could be, depending on where they are in the sky, they could be in a more ideal location in terms of determining the backgrounds that could be contaminating the signal.
So I think I didn't explain myself correctly. What I thought it was being in a cluster or in a group would have a much more massive dynamic halo.
Sure, yeah. So what I'm showing is just looking at single dwarf galaxies, but you can also, and people have done this, look at like galaxy clusters. It's different, and the J-fact, all of that would be different because you'd expect, and they tend to be much messier systems to look at. But yeah, you could look at galaxy clusters and also get limits from them. Okay, so the solid line here is the current observed bound from Fermi. And the important thing to keep in mind when you look at these plots is what's the interesting value here on the vertical axis? And the interesting value is 3 × 10⁻²⁶, because that's the annihilation cross-section that you'd want for it to be a thermal relic. Okay, so if this is weakly interacting massive particle, like we said, and you want it to have, like we were talking about yesterday, and you want it to have the right dark matter density today, that's the annihilation cross-section that you would need. Okay, so you can see it here. It's this dotted line kind of running across. So the current bounds from Fermi are starting to constrain precisely the WIMP region. Right, so it's starting to constrain, somewhere between 10 to 100 GeV of a dark matter candidate that annihilates with the cross section that would make it a thermal relic. So the results from the dwarf galaxies from Fermi are quite interesting because they're really starting to push into a well-motivated regime. And I think with time, as the measurements improve, as we get more data, and as we get better measurements of these J factors, this will really, say something fairly definitive about the swim picture. Questions on this before I move to another area of the sky? Yeah? Yeah.
So these are for BV bar. I mean, whenever I see these kinds of plots, it's always BV bar. Is there a reason that that's favored more than other channels?
No, I mean, the reason I showed, the reason why I had this one pulled up and so just put it here was because I was comparing it in previous talks to the figure on the right, which is a dark matter model that was motivated for an excess at the galactic center where it was kind of preferred to have annihilation to PB bar. But yeah.
Why it goes only to 10 GeV masses? Is there a bound, the constraint?
That is a good question. They may not have actually looked at the photons below that. So when, I'd have to go back and check the paper. It may just be that they were looking at photon energies that were higher than that. When you get to photon energies that are roughly a GeV in Fermi, you have to start being careful with how you're treating the point spread function and some of the issues from the experiment. So that might be one of the reasons why they look higher, but I'm not sure.
Wasn't the KeV line also from me?
No.
Oh, it's another.
No.
Another.
Yeah, the KeV line is was observed by X-ray. It was observed in X-ray. Yeah. All right. So the dwarf galaxies that were included in that previous analysis were discovered by SDSS. Those dwarfs are shown in blue here. And the whole region of the sky that was covered by SDSS is shown by the shaded gray. So one thing you can see is that SDSS didn't have full sky coverage. You can also see that the known dwarfs are fairly spread out in this region of the sky. They're not like kind of all clumped in one area. The hope is that as more region of the sky is covered, we're going to continue finding more of these dwarfs. And indeed, just a few months ago, the Dark Energy Survey, which was looking inside this red region here, discovered 8 more candidates, which are shown by the red dots. So that's really heartening, right? Because it's suggesting that as we kind of keep probing larger areas, we're going to maybe keep finding more of these. So not all of these dark energy, not all of these red ones have been confirmed to be dwarf galaxies. So Dark Energy Survey only gets photometric information from the stars it observes. It doesn't get kinematic information. So we don't know like the velocity of the stars that they're observing. So they don't know whether or not these clusters of stars are dark matter dominated or not. And in order to determine that, they have to do follow-up studies. And so some follow-up studies have been done on these dwarfs. And so some fraction of them actually have been confirmed as dwarf galaxies. But that story is kind of evolving. This was just, you know, news only in March. But the hope is that as more of the sky is covered, we'll find more dwarfs. And if you happen to find a dwarf that's close by, very clean environment, that's kind of all you need to really be able to push the limits down or to for discovery. So it's going to be an area that's going to be evolving a lot. All right, and the other region that you're going to want to look in, dwarf galaxies, I lost my chalk, is the galactic center. Because again, this is going to be an area where we're going to expect to have a higher density of dark matter. The results from Fermi coming from the galactic center are very contentious at the moment. There is a lot of debate about them. The reason is that there is an excess of gamma rays that is observed at the center of the galaxy. And that's shown here on the right. So this is like a snapshot of the center of the galaxy going plus or minus 20 degrees out in latitude and longitude. The things that are solid black are areas of the sky that have been masked out. And then the colors tell you how bright the intensity of photons is from that's observed from that area of the sky. The different panels show you photons in different energy ranges. So top left is 0.5 to 1 GeV. Top right is 1 to 3 GeV. Here's 3 to 10 and 10 to 50. But notice that the color scale changes from plot to plot. So in all of these, you kind of see a bright spot in the center. The bright spot isn't very significant for these two energy ranges. Where it's most significant is actually in that 1 to 3 GeV bin up there to the right. So that excess of GeV photons has been observed by several groups. It extends pretty far off the plane, almost 10 degrees off the plane. It has kind of the morphology you'd want it to have if it was following this NFW profile. And in terms of statistical significance, it's very high. There's a lot of photons that are in this region of the sky. It's just that this is an area where the astrophysical backgrounds are not very well understood. And so there's a lot of debate right now as to whether or not maybe this is some other astrophysical source that we don't understand very well that's contaminating this region. And so, yeah, I'm sure you know you're going to hear this kind of continuing for some time. Is this dark matter? Is it not dark matter? Could it be some other astrophysical source? But I thought I'd flash this up here so that you kind of are a little bit more familiar with the debate. This is what the energy spectrum looks like. I should show that before we end. So this is the energy of the photons in this region of the sky. And so you get that peak there around 1 or 2 GeV. So this is what I was saying before, that if you were to fit this with a dark matter particle, you'd fit it with roughly a 30 GeV dark matter particle that annihilates to BB bar. So that's why you might be seeing more of these BB bar plots. Any questions on this? Yeah.
What goes into those masking profiles? How are those?
The areas that are masked. So the plane is masked. You can see there's a black bar that runs across. And that's just because the galactic disk is a mess. And then the other regions that are masked here are locations of where there are known point sources. So so where we know that there are going to be bright spots on the sky, and it's certainly not dark matter. It's probably coming from some other star or something like that. Yeah. So that's why they get masked in the analysis.
By the way, next week we'll have a set of lectures on this one.
Yeah. All right. Well, so if there's no more questions on this, what I just wanted to do in the remaining minutes was to describe an interesting effect that you can get when you have dark matter annihilation. It's a non-relativistic effect, and it actually can give you some very significant enhancements in the annihilation cross-section. So it's a really nice, simple theory result. So we will come back to this a little bit. But all right, so what I want to discuss now, this effect, is called Sommerfeld enhancement. So this is going to be a non-relativistic effect, and it can give you, like I said, enhancements in your annihilation cross-section. So I'm going to just sketch out how this works, because it's such a nice picture. So let's call that our origin. We have some non-relativistic particle that's moving by this origin. Let's call this the z direction. Okay. And its wave function, its initial wave function, I can just write as follows, right? Is just moving to the right in the positive z direction. As it gets closer to the origin, so at the origin, I'm going to put a localized interaction Hamiltonian. All right, so here, there's some interaction that's occurring at that origin. And you can think about it this way, that if this is a particle that's annihilating, the annihilation is essentially occurring here, okay? So as this particle is moving here, depending on how it's interacting with whatever is at the origin, it might feel some potential, right, as it passes by this point. That potential may be attractive, it may be repulsive, it depends on the details of what's going on in the model. But regardless of whether or not it's attractive or repulsive, I can solve for the outgoing scattered state just using simple Schrodinger equation. This is just ordinary non-relativistic scattering theory. So the final state wave function in this case is just going to be a solution to the Schrodinger equation. So let me just write this out. And it's going to be subject to some, whatever the boundary conditions are in the problem. And for this, we're just going to demand that the outgoing wave be spherical. So the boundary conditions that we set on this is just that psi is going to go to e to the ikz plus f of theta e to the ikr over r as r goes to infinity. So this perturbation at the origin, what it's going to effectively do is it's going to change the cross section for the interaction. So I'm going to write that as follows, where sigma naught is just the cross section with no perturbation. And this factor here, this capital S, is going to be what's going to be referred to as the Sommerfeld factor. It's going to tell us how this perturbation ends up affecting the cross section. So the enhancement factor, the Sommerfeld SK, is just defined as being the outgoing wave function modulus squared over the ingoing wave function modulus squared. The denominator here is just 1, given my assumptions about the initial state. So this is just psi k squared. So the tools that you would use to solve this, probably saw in graduate quantum mechanics, undergrad quantum, I'm not going to really outline them in full detail here. It's just sort of standard techniques that you would use to solve the Schrodinger equation. Instead, what I want to do is to just kind of show how this plays out for the assumption of a particular form for this potential. Because the form that we're going to consider is relevant to what you might get in some dark matter models. So let's consider the case where the potential is just minus some constant over the distance between the incoming particle and the origin. Maybe, how did I define it? I put a 2 here. So this potential gets substituted into the Schrodinger equation above. I can redefine some variables. So let's say if I define, If I define R to be the following times X, then I can rewrite, I'm trying to think what's best. There's probably no need to go into all of these details. I'll just tell you what the final answer is. So I substitute this in there, plug and chug with the standard solving of the Schrodinger equation techniques, and then the final result that I get is going to be the following. Where our epsilon here is velocity over this constant alpha. So as the final exercise, maybe just spend a minute or two seeing what happens here. What is the Sommerfeld factor when what happens when epsilon goes to infinity, and what happens when the velocities are very small?
Sorry, what is sigma actually? I lost what we're going
to go. What is
sigma? You wrote sigma equals sigma.
Oh, sigma is the cross section for this interaction.
And then, so you, in the pictures, you have some particle of mass m coming in the middle there's another particle. Is that the idea?
There's some interaction that occurs.
So is that another particle?
Yeah, you can think of it as another particle that it annihilates with. Yes.
Okay. And why does it say delta 3 of r there in the Hamiltonian, but then afterwards you have a 1 over r in your potential?
Oh, yeah, because I generalized it to, I'll erase this. Yeah. So here I was just considering the case where it was localized. But
I see.
Yeah, now in this scenario, we're going to consider it where you can think of it as another particle here and there's some long range interaction with the other one that's passing by.
And how do you get the cross section? Okay, just find the amplitude for that process.
Yes.
I see.
Well, you think about it as, you know, the usual cross section with Miranda order sigma zero is the cross section you compute with a plane wave incoming. But if you have long range interaction, your incoming wave function is not a plane wave.
Mm-hmm.
So that essentially accounts for the perturbation.
I see. And is it obvious that you can just separate your new solution will be equal to some correction times your old solution? Is that
there's a theorem that says you can split it up like this. Yeah, it's the Bethe Sapelter. I don't know if I'm pronouncing the second name correctly. Theorem. Yeah. This. So in the case where we have epsilon is infinite, right? That's going to correspond to a large velocity, right, for the particle coming in. And what does that imply for this enhancement factor? Yeah. So in this limit, sk just goes to 1. Which just means that the cross-section doesn't change. And that makes sense, because in this limit, this guy just zips by so fast, he hardly even notices that there's anything going on here at the origin. Now, in the limit where epsilon goes to 0, which is in the low-velocity limit, there's two things that can happen, and it'll depend on whether or not alpha is positive or negative. So I can either have sk go to pi alpha over v, and this will happen when, say, alpha is equal to 1, positive.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can have sk go to e to the minus pi alpha over v, and that's going to happen when alpha is negative, okay? So depending on the nature of this potential, I can either end up getting an enhancement in the cross section or a suppression in the cross section.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on the nature of the long range force. Okay. Sorry?
The limit.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah. So the important case here, the interesting case, is this one, which tells us that in the limit where this guy is going by slowly, and I have a minus 1 over r potential, that the annihilation cross-section is going to be enhanced relative to what I would otherwise expect. It's just a non-relativistic effect, okay? So what does this all mean for dark matter? Why should you care? Well, turns out that A, dark matter is non-relativistic. B, it often ends up that you can end up with these potentials between the two incoming particles that actually end up giving you this enhancement. So as one case study example, let's go back to the scenario of we know dark matter from yesterday. So this is an example of a type of neutralino particle. So you don't really have to remember the details because I'll just outline it here. So when I have we know dark matter, I can get this kind of annihilation. Chi chi goes to WW, which would give me a continuum signal, right? I can also get a line signal as follows. Chi chi photon photon. This is a W boson, and then these are chargenos. So if they annihilate through a loop, I can also go directly into photons. The interesting thing happens in this case here, actually in both cases, but the non-relativistic, the Sommerfeld enhancement occurs because you can actually just have ladder diagrams where you just keep exchanging these W bosons back and forth between the incoming particles. And this continuous exchange of the W bosons gives you an effective potential, which can be somewhat complicated at times, but there are regions where it ends up simplifying essentially to just this attractive potential here, and you end up getting an enhancement in the annihilation cross-section. So I'll just show you a plot just to end here that illustrates just how, you know, including these kinds of effects is important in terms of all right, so there's kind of a lot on this plot, and there's really no need to really focus on a lot of the details. But I wanted to show you this because it shows what happens to the enhancement. So the blue line here, this is essentially the mass of the WINO. And the blue line here is the annihilation cross-section to gamma-gamma and gamma-z. It's actually summed. The effect of the Sommerfeld enhancement is to give you this peak, this very sharp peak here at around 2.1 TeV. So if you happen to have a WINO that falls in that range, the annihilation cross-section is considerably larger than what you would otherwise expect it to be. And it's actually because of that enhancement that we can exclude some of these scenarios here of very heavy WINOs, because the cross-sections are actually larger than you would naively expect, precisely because you end up getting this kind of enhancement. The Sommerfeld enhancement picture, so I've shown you that, you know, it occurs in these types of SUSY scenarios, but you get it in a bunch of different types of models, and people thought a lot about this a few years back when there was an excess of positrons in the PAMELA data. And one way to try to kind of get boosts in the annihilation cross-section for the dark matter was to have these non-relativistic effects occur so that you'd end up with enhancements. Yeah?
What exactly, speaking out the scale,
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a simple answer to that. That's a good question. Okay, so this was roughly the last thing I wanted to show, just in connection to indirect detection. And I hope that with both the examples that we've explored with direct and indirect detection, you can kind of see that there's a lot of interesting results that kind of come out of thinking about this problem in this non-relativistic fashion. You could get some, in this case, particularly unexpected results from thinking about it this way. So I hope that over the last few lectures, you've gotten better, broader picture of what the possibilities are for dark matter and how we might explore for them. And if you have any additional questions, I'm happy to take them now or later, or feel free to send me any emails if anything comes up afterwards. I will probably scan my handwritten notes so that Itai might send them all out to you over the next few days.
Depending on how well you behave.
Okay. Yeah, so if any questions come up, even when you're looking through those, feel free to send me an email. All right, thank you.